it's 1400 and something. And Italy is ground zero for a cultural movement that would impact art, architecture, and exploration across Europe. This was, of course, the Renaissance. The opportunity to shine was limitless, but success and failure were on a collision course as the populace sought to showcase their talents, whether they possessed them or did not. The art world celebrated Da Vinci's Mona Lisa while simultaneously agonizing over Snodgrass's whiny Jemima. Devotees of architecture swooned over Brunelleschi's Duomo in Florence while squinting painfully at Lafayette's Mofo in Paris. The unmitigated joy around the advent of opera was quickly mitigated when some dickhead penned the first musical. It was yin and yang, the light versus the dark, in a constant dynamic cycle. The Renaissance had sparked a belief that anything was possible. Mankind's only issue now was separating the wheat from the chaff. I'm Sir General Roland Frampton, and I'll be recognizing the sweat, blood, and tears of those who didn't quite make the grade. So, the next time you find yourself describing the beauty of Daniel Fahrenheit's first mercury thermometer to a venture capitalist or an exhausted junior doctor, please bear in mind Aubrey Rectum's earlier prototype, which broke in his trouser pocket, stabbed him in the leg, and gave him enough mercury poisoning to kill a flock of seagulls. We live in a world of fine margins.
A Brief History of Failure, presented by Sir General Roland Frampton. Episode 3, The Renaissance.
So, let us away to the Renaissance, where the aristocracy grinned smugly, their wealth matched only by their stupidity, and their demand for shiny things, which paved the way for an ocean of tosh and codswallop. Picture, if you will, Johannes Gutenberg watching another Bible lurch off his printing press, safe in the knowledge he hadn't been beaten to the punch by wealthy Dutch silk merchant Horst Spitz. Spitz was a paper's width away from being credited with giving the world its first lithograph, having mastered the technique of printing using a rudimentary cheese press. Spitz's undoing, however, was his use of goat's urine rather than standard ink, which rendered his prints completely illegible. When dead collectors entered Spitz's house on Kalverstraat after his death, they found only piles of blank paper and the most dreadful smell in his understairs cupboard. As inventions became the mother of invention, intrepid European adventurers gazed out across the ocean, musing on what lay beyond the horizon. Their motivation to explore was simple. New territories promised new wealth. To reach new lands before a contemporary meant daylight robbery could begin apace. In 1500, Pedro Cabal discovered Brazil, thus securing the world's supply of Quality Street. And when John Cabot stumbled on Newfoundland and founded Labrador, he made a fortune exporting puppies. With me is Salmon O'Hare, head of anthropology at Dublin College. Salmon, is it true many explorers set out in search of countries that were never likely to exist?
Jesus, Roland. So many feckin' Egypts cluelessly setting off into the unknown. All abandoned, tossed overboard before they'd even left the feckin' harbour.
I see you have some pictures of said individuals on your phone there.
So this first feck in Egypt, Ferdinand Orange, went off looking for the Spoon Coast, a place he'd created in his head as a four-year-old orphan. Roland, 54 sailors lost their lives because of this feckin' gobshite. And there's this Portuguese joker, Luigi Mazzarini, led 43 members of the Lisbon Geographical Society to their deaths, on the promise of finding the fabled land of Fantastico. Their ship, Il Disastro, which was a piece of shite by the way, sank 19 seconds after leaving port. And then this Austrian wastrel, Karen Müller, set out single-handedly to discover Jamaica, or so she said. Never left the feckin' pub on the docks by all accounts.
But isn't Austria landlocked?
Don't you feckin' start.
I'm here at Hampton Court, Henry VIII's infamous residence and pleasure dome, standing next to a mock-up of a 16th century gallows, which local children are getting a guided tour around. I'm delighted to say Bothwell Sedgemoor has taken some time out from the graphic demonstrations to provide some insights on the role of the Renaissance executioner. Hello, Bothwell.
All right, boy.
Bothwell, what were the major differences between a top slayer and a piss-poor one?
Well, a lot of those who started out simply couldn't manage the basics. First off, you gotta keep the axe blade at exactly 38 degrees. Otherwise, you won't clean the spine in one go.
No!
See? Another problem was the executioner's hood. A lot of these flyboy night killers would have all this fancy headwear. It was like a bloody episode of Nacho Libre.
I think you'll find Nacho Libre was a Mexican wrestling film rather than an episodic series.
Anyways, it was a simple black hood with two oils that works best.
No!
See?
And well, what about female applicants?
Well, the flat-chested ones, not a bother. But you get one with big titties, and they're going to swing that axe way off course. It's why you saw so many prisoners back in the day with the tops of their heads missing.
No!
See?
On the 23rd of April, 1564, Mr. and Mrs. Shakespeare gave birth to their eighth son, William, and sent him straight to school. Widely regarded as the world's preeminent dramatist, Shakespeare produced 39 plays. A copy of each can be found in the British Library between Homer's Iliad and 50 Shades of Grey. When Billy died in 1616, access to his personal journals uncovered some startling revelations, including how he taunted his wife, Anne Hathaway, with sticks of rhubarb and his habitual need to place the family beagle, Rufus Shakespeare, into an hypnotic state. But perhaps the most surprising discovery was an entry of theatrical lines that had been offered to the bard by his brother, Gilbert. Shakespeare know-it-all and wing attack for Stratford-upon-Avon's netball team, Hamilton Vanguard, picks up the story.
Now is the winner of our two-man tent.
I'm assuming, Hamilton, that William refused to add that to Richard III.
It's astonishing, isn't it, how richer the soliloquy would have been with that in. Is this a badger I see before me? I mean, Gilbert clearly had a way with words, and frankly, if that line had been incorporated into Macbeth, I, for one, would have had a much better idea of what the fuck was going on in that story. Go on, pick any stanza from the journal.
Let me see. Here's one. Uneasy lies the bread that slices brown. That's just sensational.
See what I mean, Sir Roland? I'm literally left speechless by Shakespeare's omission of these wondrous literary gems.
Do you think William felt threatened, that this was sibling rivalry at its worst? Don't the journals suggest he was rather angry at his brother's interference.
Some are born irate. Some achieve irateness. Some have irateness thrust upon them. Says it all, doesn't it?
Prior to the Great Plague of London in 1665 and the Great Fire of London in 1666, a series of other calamitous events of London could equally have laid waste to the nation's capital. Mary Scuttletrunk is leading an archaeological dig underneath the gents' toilets here at Cockfosters tube station. She has unearthed valuable documents which tell us of these unrealised catastrophes.
In 1661, the Great Stampede of London began when circus performers, unhappy with mandatory union fees, released a marauding herd of elephants into the capital streets. The animals got as far as Mrs. Johnson's current bun emporium in Shoreditch, and the moment was lost. Here's another Sir Roland. Disgruntled at the introduction of a punitive magic tax, Scottish magician, the Great Mephisto, planned a full-scale hypnotic event, the Great Amnesia of London, in 1662. However, while rehearsing in front of a mirror, he put himself in a permanent catatonic state, and the moment was lost.
It looks like you have a third there, Mrs. Scuttletrunk.
Yes, the great flatulence of London loomed large when the government removed housing benefits from workers in the horseradish industry in 1664. The aggrieved workforce set about consuming vast quantities of their company's products before descending ours first onto the city. A sudden change of wind direction blew their putrid miasma away from the capital, and the moment was lost.
By the middle of the 18th century, the speed of progress was breathtaking. Both the Bank of England and the British Museum had been founded, and a new Gregorian calendar had been officially adopted, which looked lovely on decorative mantelpieces. The first rules of golf were established in 1744 by the Honourable Company of Edinburgh Golfers, and 10 years later, the R&A had formulated a golf stroke nomenclature.
The R&A dismissed several suggestions for the nomenclature before landing on the terms we all recognise today.
Hamish McSealbeater is on the board of the R&A and spends a lot of his time reflecting. Hamish, what nomenclature proposals fail to make the cut?
Ah, very good, Sir Roland. Elsie McAvertash, who raked the bunker on the 14th fairway at St Andrews, had probably the most preposterous suggestions.
I understand she was a keen twitcher. What did she come up with for the under-par scores, which we now know collectively as birdie, eagle and albatross?
For a one under-par, she posited a festive grouse. For two under, you made a fearful owl. And for three under par, you bagged a pregnant partridge.
And for the over par scores of bogey, double bogey, etc.?
One over par was a bollock. Two over was a double bollock. While a triple bogey would be known as a go fuck yourself.
Hamish, did Elsie have an alternative for par?
Yes, even par was a turnip.
The second half of the 18th century saw Samuel Johnson add the final word Z-bed to his dictionary. Alexander Cummings waved goodbye to a surprisingly loose stool down the world's first flushing toilet. But this was a turbulent time, and a revolution was in the air. After the Sprout Act of 1764 failed to control the proliferation of spherical vegetables in the British colony of America, the punitive tax was expunged by bureaucrats in Brussels. Slighted by the action, George III's Parliament went on to impose two further impositions on the American degenerates, the Stamp Act and the Tea Act. By 1773, however, the Yanks were totally cheesed off at being unable to have a cup of splosh while addressing a first day cover to a favourite nephew or great aunt. It's December the 16th, 1773, and under the cover of dark, some 400 Bostonians are approaching three ships that have recently moored in Boston Harbour. Many are disguised as Native Americans, policemen, construction workers, and cowboys. In fact, they resembled one giant Village People tribute band. They only had one thing on their minds, however. Anarchy. Jennifer Clanbuckle homeschools her children in the ways of the American revolutionist and joins me tonight in a cozy hostelry near the city's dockyards. Jennifer, this hostile horde were clearly out looking for a blend of tea and trouble. But hadn't they targeted the wrong vessels? Can you fill in the blanks for us?
You're right, Sir Roland. This rabble was out to make a point about Britain's anti-competitive restrictions on tea.
But I thought Americans only drank pumpkin spice lattes. Why the fuck were they worried about tea leaves?
I think it was more about politicizing tea rather than merely imbibing.
Do go on, Miss Clanbuckle.
The crowd split into three so they could surprise each vessel simultaneously. The first raiding party was led by Chuck Hamstring, who was a lay preacher on his night off. His group stormed HMS Gallbladder and were quickly below deck and into the ship's stores.
What did they find?
Acorns.
What?
Oh, the 18th century acorn trade was huge. Massive.
Really? Okay, well, what did the second vessel offer up?
HMS Spatula was a little tougher to penetrate. The raiding party, led by 4-year-old Alice Cockletoes, met with some pretty stiff resistance. But they prevailed and managed to dump over 9 tons of balsamic vinegar into Boston Harbor.
For no political gain whatsoever.
None. And it reduced mussel yields in the Bay Area for decades.
And the third?
Well, as I'm sure you're aware, the French were already assisting America's struggles against the English and had several mercenaries in country at the time. Jean Valvache, a swordsman from Marseille, made short shrift of the crew on board HMS Effeminate and descended below. The crowd stood in amazement when Vache resurfaced in tears, holding a wheel of Gorgonzola. Of course, the Frenchmen wouldn't allow any dumping of the cheese, and those who tried felt the pointy sting of Vache's sword.
So, where were the ships that had the tea?
On the other side of the harbor wall.
For the next 3 years, these pesky colonialists fought for an independence that was declared and adopted on July 4th, 1776, in Pennsylvania State House. It would take another 12 years before the United States would have its fabled constitution. As this vintage recording from 1789 reminds us, these half-witted cattle thieves took an age just to come up with a headline for the legal document.
We sat in Independence Hall all scratching our heads over how to start this thing. We the Parsnip was the first suggestion, followed by We the Perpendicular. We didn't arrive at We the People for another 8 months.
While convention delegates in Philadelphia took aim at each other over the Second Amendment, the Bastille in Paris was being stormed by revolutionaries. Around lunchtime on the 14th of July, 1789, the insurgents seized control of the medieval armory. Predictably, several other misguided subverters were storming establishments of lesser political importance at the same time. With me in this Café au Lait, situated in the shadow of the infamous prison, is Gabriel Borsin. Gabriel, is it true your great-great-grandfather laid siege to a bakery in the Latin Quarter?
Oh, hello, bonjour. C'est vrai. He attacked Le Petit Boulanger to remove cakes and bread with aristocratic associations, but it was half-day closing.
Tant pis. What other onslaughts lost their way?
Well, Sir Roland, Pierre Macaroon, and his fellow workers at Le Post Office charged into the L'Académie de Surgery. They had strong intel that Louis XVI was in outpatients with an irritable bowel. However, the intel was merde. And then, freedom fighter Muriel Debauchery forced her way into a local branch of the Bank of Amsterdam to seize the offshore cash of French nobles, only to realize she'd forgotten her PIN number.
In 3 years, France would have its first republic. 12 years after that, France would have its first empire under Napoleon. And 173 years after that, France would have its first win at the Eurovision Song Contest. But as mankind lurched into the 19th century, it was science that was grabbing all the headlines, and not always for the right reasons. Next time on A Brief History of Failure, as Charles Babbage begins building the first programmable mechanical computer, I'll be asking who missed a trick on electromotors.
Baron von Cupboard tried to build a dynamo by attaching tiny electromagnets to the backs of dancing bees. The results were disappointing.
And as Louis Braille set about creating 3D paper, I'll be examining the failed attempts to devise the first gas stove.
The common mode of failure in this field of invention was to blow oneself to pieces. But Esmeralda Trilobite, a former Miss Venezuela, succeeded in not just gassing herself to death, but also her husband, her mother, and her mother's mobile hairstylist.
And while the high-waisted silhouette was all the rage in fashion circles, I'll be finding out why the herringbone corset was a non-starter. All this and more next time on A Brief History of Failure.
A Brief History of Failure was written, produced, and performed by me, Aid Corey. A book of this podcast is available on Amazon.